we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here with you on the program today. Glad to have you here on the show. This is our Monday edition of the program. A lot of news to cover with the second attempted assassination of President Trump taking place yesterday. A lot to cover this hour. So we'll have some guests in the last segment. But for the first two segments, we're going to hone in on this story out of Palm Beach and West Palm Beach, Florida. Before we do that, I want to turn our attention to the scripture. Psalm 128 is where we are this week. How blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. When you shall eat of the fruit of your hands, you will be happy and it will be well with you. Your wife shall be like a fruitful vine within your house, your children like olive plants around your table. Behold, for thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. So the fear of the Lord is healthy, it's good. And verse 2 talks about when you shall eat of the fruit of your hands. So we should fear the Lord, point number one. But number two, we should work with our hands. That's what God created Adam and Eve for in the garden. And the same is true today. We should eat from the labor of our very own hands. Scripture talks also about the man who doesn't provide for his family, for the welfare of his family. It says that he's worse than an unbeliever, worse than an infidel. That's what the scripture says. So fearing the Lord and eating from the fruits of our own labor is biblical indeed. Well, moving into the story for today, the big story is that there was a second attempted assassination on President Trump's life yesterday, Sunday, on September 15th. And this news came, some could say it came as a surprise. Others might not say, may say we're not surprised, but to me, it came as a surprise because of the level of protection that should be around President Trump. This raises a lot of questions about the protective perimeter around President Trump, and we're going to get into that. I've got several clips today, a lot of different sources, but, you know, this is not going to be a bash the Secret Service per se. Segment, although there's some problems with the Secret Service that need to be pointed out, but it was a Secret Service agent that actually protected the president in this case. The same thing with the first attempted assassination in Butler, Pennsylvania. It was a Secret Service sniper that took out the shooter. So blame can be placed within the Secret Service, but these agents in these cases, the actual agents that are within the perimeter of the president, are ones protecting him. And in both of these cases, they saved his life. So this really rises to the level of leadership in the Secret Service. This rises to the level of who's calling the shots, who's making the decisions in the Secret Service when it comes to the overarching protective bubble around President Trump. This goes higher than just your average agent that's putting his life on the line for the president. This gets up higher than that. It gets to who's in charge of making the decisions about the protective planning and the protective bubble around President Trump. That's where the responsibility lies. And unfortunately, we've gotten little answers about what exactly went wrong in Butler, Pennsylvania. You know, and this is the problem with the Democrats being in charge is they're very secretive. They're very withholding of information. And, I mean, think about all of the scandals that Obama covered up. Think about the scandals that Clinton covered up. And the Democrats are notorious for covering up their own mistakes and their own failures. And Butler, Pennsylvania is no different. I mean, we ought to be having daily press conferences where we're told exactly what happened, when it happened, and who's responsible. But we still don't know what went wrong. Did the Secret Service fail to cover the roof? Did the Secret Service, you know, punt it off on the local PD? What on earth happened? I mean, a lot of this stuff is up in the air. And a lot of the only ways we find out information now is through investigative journalism. I mean, a lot of the information that we do know about the shooting in Butler, Pennsylvania, is because of investigative journalism. It's not because we were being told at press conferences. And that's sad. It's frustrating. And the mainstream media conglomerates of the world ought to care about this stuff. But nonetheless, jumping into what happened yesterday with this attempted assassination of President Trump, the second one in just under 2 months, let's break this down, what we know thus far. The suspect has been apprehended. He was apprehended within probably the hour after the attempted assassination. President Trump was at his golf course in Palm Beach, West Palm Beach, at Trump International Golf Club. And he was on hole number 5, reportedly. Secret Service, of course, was in the perimeter. And there was reportedly, this is once again, this is all based off reporting. It's hard to really nail down all the specific details this early, but there was apparently a Secret Service advance team ahead of President Trump on the next hole. And then there was a team, of course, with the president and, of course, a team behind the president. So the president was being protected by the Secret Service in the immediate perimeter. But what we learned is that outside of that immediate perimeter, there was very little protection. Very little protection, to such a degree that this suspect got within somewhere between 300 to 500 yards of the president with a gun, with a rifle. And these are the distances that are being reported. And he got within 300 to 500 yards of President Trump with a long, a rifle, a long gun. And he set up, this suspect had set up basically a sniper's nest in the brush on the perimeter of the golf course. And news broke, I don't know, within the last hour or two about how long the suspect was on site. 12 hours, roughly. According to cell phone data that was on the suspect, he arrived at the golf course about 1:59 a.m. on Sunday morning, so in the middle of the night, and of course was there until the shooting took place at 1:30 p.m. So roughly 12 hours, the suspected shooter was on site at the Trump International Golf Course. One noteworthy item out of all of this, a lot of it's noteworthy, but one in particular I want to point out, is that this golf outing was off the books. This golf outing was not on President Trump's public schedule. So the number of people that would have had access to the fact that President Trump was going on a golf outing would have been relatively tight. I don't know, maybe a couple dozen? Of course, the Secret Service knows where the president's going golfing. Some of his top-level advisors probably know where the president is going golfing and when he's going golfing. Some of his family members probably knew. But outside of, I don't know, maybe a couple dozen at most people, this was not a publicly listed event. So how did this shooter know at least 12 hours in advance that President Trump was going to be on site at the golf course? What were the connections of the previous suspect up in Butler, Pennsylvania? What were his connections? You know, he had two encrypted devices on his person, and we still don't know what was on those devices. Who was he communicating with? Why did he have multiple devices? And so The attempted assassin was on site at least 12 hours at Trump International Golf Course. Once again, this was not a public event. How did the shooter know that President Trump was going to be on the golf course? Let's play at least a clip here before we hit a break. All right, let's play clip three. This is a former FBI agent. Let's play clip three. This is a former FBI special agent, counterterrorism agent, talking about the verbiage that the Democrats used to describe Trump. Clip three.
I'm focused on finding out how he knew Trump's movements and where he was. Nearly every type of attack is preceded by what's known as pre-attack surveillance. Terrorist attacks, bank robberies, almost any criminal tries to gain intelligence on their target and then uses that to plan the attack. As we saw in Butler, Pennsylvania, the kid put the drone up in the air to see where the security was weakest, took advantage of that, getting up on that roof where there was no protection at all, and use that to take the shot at Trump. Now, this guy may have been watching Mar-a-Lago, may have seen the motorcade move, watched where they went, saw they went to the golf course, and figured at some point in time they'll be coming by hole five and six.
No.
We don't know, and that's something we definitely need to know.
Yeah. Well, to give the gentleman credit there, that was a former FBI counterterrorism expert on CNN talking about how did this suspect know that President Trump was going to hit the golf course. He probably wasn't privy to the information that we have now that the suspect was on site for 12 plus hours. So that interview was conducted yesterday. So to his defense, he probably didn't have this latest breaking news that the suspect was on the golf course for 12 hours leading up to this attempted assassination attempt. But nonetheless, his point is valid in that how did the suspect know that President Trump was going to be at the golf course? This wasn't a rally. This wasn't a campaign event. This wasn't a, you know, predetermined, pre-announced, publicly noted event. How on earth did this suspect know that President Trump was going to hit the golf course? And if to his point, to that former FBI agent's point, if this suspect was scouting out Mar-a-Lago, and that being on that golf course for 12 hours, folks, that to me, that is the elephant in the room. Okay, because if he weren't on the golf course for 12 hours before this attempted assassination, then you could plausibly say that this lowlife was staking out outside of Mar-a-Lago and simply followed the motorcade, although that's very difficult to do. Followed the motorcade to the golf course and just got out of his car and got his gun and headed to the golf course. But once again, this whole 12-hour thing is a big, big deal. The sheriff down there in Palm Beach, Martin County is the county, but this sheriff, Will Snyder, of Martin County. A reporter asked him at a press conference yesterday, does Ryan Ruth, which is the name of the suspect, have any ties to Martin County? The sheriff said, the answer to my knowledge, the answer is no. I think that we're finding out he's not from this area, which of course raises the bigger question, how does this guy from not around here get all the way to Trump International, realize that the president, the former president of the United States, is golfing, and is able to get a rifle in that vicinity? I think that's the question the FBI and the Secret Service are laser focused on today. Is this guy part of a conspiracy? He went on to say, or is he a lone gunman? If he's a lone gunman, President Trump is much safer because we have him. But if he's part of a conspiracy, then this whole thing really takes an ominous tone. That's the question we need to know. Is this part of a larger scheme? Is this part of multiple bad actors that are trying to assassinate President Trump? And Butler, Pennsylvania was simply installment one of their attempt.
twice a year, American Family Radio opens the phone lines to ask for listener support in our effort to promote godly values. We call it Share-a-thon. And it's also your chance to tell us your AFR story.
I was headed to work one morning and just happened upon the radio station, and I honestly don't think that my station has changed since then.
If God has used AFR in your life, we'd love to hear you tell us about it.
I've been a big help in keeping my mind straight and walking with the Lord. Thank y'all very much.
Your story can be an encouragement to our radio staff and to other listeners as well.
AFR has helped me out a lot. It helps me to keep in touch with the Lord. It's a good reminder that God loves us.
Call us at 877-876-8893 and give us a one-minute voicemail telling us your AFR story. That's 877-876-8893. And then listen for your voice during Share-a-thon, October 8th, 9th, and 10th on American Family Radio.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core. Welcome back to the second segment. So the attempted assassin, the suspect that's been arrested, donated 19 times to the Democrats. 19 donations to the Democrats. Also went on his social media pages, railing against President Trump. Traveled to Ukraine at least once, maybe on multiple occasions, in favor of the war in Ukraine. Also reportedly wrote a book that was published in the last few years where he talked about how Iran should assassinate President Trump. He was a convicted felon, so he wasn't legally supposed to be possessing the firearm that he had, which shows that gun control doesn't work, right? The criminals are going to get the guns no matter what. He had a Biden-Harris bumper sticker on his truck. This is all coming out from Breitbart today. Secret Service, Biden admits today, the Secret Service needs more help. Here's another thing that's going to have to be answered. And thankfully, Governor DeSantis is running a parallel investigation, which let's go ahead and play that before I get talking too much. This is clip 5, Governor DeSantis on the active investigation in Palm Beach. Let's listen.
I have not talked to him yet. I did announce yesterday, you know, we're going to be doing a state level investigation. I understand that the feds are involved, but we do believe that there were multiple violations of state law. We also believe that there's a need to make sure that the truth about all this comes out in a way, you know, that's credible. I mean, I look at the federal government with all due respect to them. You know, those same agencies that are prosecuting Trump in that jurisdiction are now going to be investigating this. I just think that may not be the best thing for this country. Nevertheless, they have their prerogative, but we have our prerogative. And so we'll be making an announcement further along those lines in the ensuing days.
So there you have it. That's the Governor DeSantis announcing a parallel investigation. So I think this investigation is going to be more transparent, not because of the FBI, not because of the Biden Department of Justice, but because Governor DeSantis is running a parallel investigation, which is smart. It's the right thing to do. And it happened in his jurisdiction. So we'll be hearing from Governor DeSantis and his agencies on their investigation. When it comes to this golf course, by the way, it's just, I mentioned this to Bobby, I mentioned it to a few people today. When you look on the aerial photography of and the mapping of this golf course, I mean, this is in a pretty suburban setting, pretty urban setting. I mean, in the heart of Palm Beach, West Palm Beach. And the perimeter is roads. I mean, it's major thoroughfares. On all four sides of this golf course is businesses, neighborhoods, and major thoroughfares. So why this perimeter wasn't even checked or covered? And once again, these reports that the gunman was on site for up to 12 hours before, I've got two major questions. These are blaring questions. Was there no perimeter protection outside of the immediate perimeter? You can't call 300 yards really perimeter protection. That's immediate vicinity protection. So we've got four major thoroughfares, very developed roads around this golf course that are actually pretty straight. One of them takes a slight bend, but otherwise, three of the four roads are straight shots, meaning you could have a patrol vehicle on all four of these sides of the golf course, and they've got line of sight on the entire perimeter of this course. So anybody toting a gun, an AK-47, across a four lane is going to get spotted by the patrol vehicle. So why the Secret Service didn't work out a deal with the Sheriff's Department to run perimeter protection around this golf course in vehicles is beyond me. Furthermore, and once again, we don't know what we don't know, but did the Secret Service run a perimeter check? Did they sweep the perimeter of this golf course before the president showed up? This is kind of a big deal. This is like elementary 101 security, dignitary protection stuff. This is not complicated stuff. So we've got a suspect reportedly on the golf course for 12 hours. And Secret Service shows up with the president, and nobody ran the perimeter of that golf course with canines? Nobody ran the perimeter of the golf course with thermal imaging drones? This is technology widely available to law enforcement. I mean, this is just like, and the government and the media wonders why that there's conspiracies out there. Because they leave room for the conspiracies. Extreme negligence, folks, does not explain this stuff. It does not explain Butler, Pennsylvania, and it does not explain what happened yesterday in Florida. I don't care if it's the B team. This is elementary level, dignitary protection, and we're not covering the perimeter. We're not doing any type of sweeps to catch a gunman in the bushes at the golf course. And I don't want to hear, oh, the Secret Service doesn't have the resources. Hogwash. This agency has billions at its disposal. Billions at its disposal. And we can't do a perimeter check at the golf course? I mean, this is laughable stuff. And the problem is that the left isn't gonna tamp down the rhetoric. I've told you this from the first assassination attempt. I told you the next day that the left is unable to tone down the rhetoric. Why? Because they have no self-control. They have no self-check. And even the FBI agent that I just played a clip of in the last segment, part two of this is where he tells CNN, this is on CNN, folks. He tells CNN that, hey, if you call somebody Hitler for 8 years, for 6 years, for 4 years, what do you think's going to happen? Somebody's going to be the hero here. Let's listen to this. This is clip four.
I would think we're going to find that this guy's extremely politically motivated and that he probably was spurred on by much of the political diatribes that are going on these days, talking about Trump, equating him to Hitler and things like that. So I don't think this is the last we'll see of crazies out there trying to do this.
There you go. FBI agent there saying, hey, look, if you call somebody Hitler for 4 years, what do you think is going to happen? And this is what they've been doing. Folks, this is all intentional. This is all intentional. You amp up the rhetoric, you demonize somebody so much that it doesn't take long for a crazy to catch on and say that he's going to be the next hero. Okay? In his eyes. And this is what's happening with these gunmen. And once again, the left is unable to self-check. The beautiful thing about the Holy Spirit and God's gift on believers is this thing called conviction, this thing called self-check. But the left in our country is so so focused in on evil, they're so focused in on the destruction of the West, that anyone who gets in their way, they will demonize them, they will destroy their life. Look, we've been doing this at AFA long before this Trump era. Okay, it's this thing called the Southern Poverty Law Center. They put us and the Family Research Council and all these other Christian ministries on their hate map. Well, then what happened at FRC? A shooter went in with Chick-fil-A sandwiches and wanted to kill everybody at FRC and was going to wipe the sandwiches on their faces after he murdered them. We had, I told you guys last week about this, we had a suspect. Thankfully, the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office got involved. But he sent a Facebook message saying that he was going to come to our headquarters and kill all of leadership. Facebook, by the way, said that wasn't a violation of their terms of use and their community guidelines. Thankfully, the U.S. attorney and the FBI got involved, and he did 6 months in the federal pen. To prove that the rhetoric is dangerous and it's all coming from the left, let's listen to about 2 minutes of Democrats and the media comparing Trump to Hitler and conservatives as a threat to democracy. Clip two.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be.
People need to start taking to the streets. This is a dictator.
You know, there needs to be unrest in the streets for as long as there is unrest in our lives.
Enemies of the state.
Show me where it says that protests are supposed to be polite and peaceful.
Do something about your dad's immigration practices, you feckless.
When they go low, we kick.
How do you resist the temptation to run up and wring her neck?
Biggest terror threat in this country is white men, most of them radicalized right up to the right.
I thought he should have punched him in the face. I said, even if you lost, he insulted your wife.
Yes.
He came down the escalator and called Mexicans rapists and murderers. He said, well, what do you think I should have done? I said, I think you should have punched him in the face and then gotten out of the race. You would have been a hero.
I'd like to punch him in the face. I said, if we were in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
Punch some people in the face!
When was the last time an actor assassinated a president?
They're still going to have to go out and put a bullet in Donald Trump, and that's a fact.
Look, as his character is stabbed to death.
Where is John Wilkes Booth when you need him?
I have thought an awful lot about blowing up the White House.
A Missouri state senator is under investigation by the Secret Service after saying she hopes President Trump is assassinated.
I will go and take Trump out tonight.
And if you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome anymore, anywhere.
And sadly, the domestic enemies to our voting system and our honoring our Constitution are right at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
They're not going to stop before Election Day in November, and they're not going to stop after Election Day. And that should be, everyone should take note of that on both levels, that this isn't, they're not going to let up, and they should not.
If you think we're rallying now, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Well, there you have it, folks. That's just over 2 minutes of Kamala Harris, Maxine Waters, Chuck Schumer, and the likes comparing President Trump and his supporters to Hitler, to Nazis, calling them a threat to democracy, saying that they're domestic terrorists. This is the Democrat Party. This is the media. And we wonder why things get violent. The fact that their language is treated as normal and acceptable is beyond me. And these are the folks in charge, by the way. This isn't a fringe political element. This isn't a fringe, you know, small part of the party. This is mainstream Democrats. And in that clip, Kamala Harris was actually talking about the protesters that were burning down America's cities in 2020. She said they shouldn't stop. They need to keep going. I hope they're hearing this. But President Trump's the bad guy, they say. Mean tweets. President Trump's the bad guy. To show how cold, to show how senseless this has become, MSNBC, one of their anchors, had the audacity yesterday, within hours after a second attempted assassination, MSNBC host Alex Witt had the audacity to ask the Trump campaign if they would tone down the rhetoric. Clip six.
Expect there to be calls from within the Trump campaign to do that, because he's going to reach out to his supporters and say, let's take this down. We do not know, again, the source of any gunshot or gunshots. We don't know who's responsible for this. The whole thing has yet to be 100% confirmed from start to finish how this all played out. But do you expect to hear anything from the Trump campaign about toning down the rhetoric?
Well, there you have it. MSNBC, within hours after a second attempted assassination on President Trump, MSNBC, the only thing they have to say is, I wonder if President Trump's going to tell his supporters to tone down the rhetoric. Whoa. Last time I checked, it's not Trump supporters going out trying to assassinate politicians. Folks, this is a common occurrence. Maybe not the assassination attempts, although it's becoming quite common. But the political violence from the left is becoming commonplace. I talked about the case with Family Research Council earlier. I talked about the case with AFA earlier. What about the Steve Scalise shooter? Bernie Sanders supporter. Going to the GOP baseball practice and he was going to gun down as many of those right-wing Republicans as he could. Butler County, Pennsylvania. Going there to be the hero. Where was he getting fed information? Where was the Butler, Pennsylvania shooter? Where was he radicalized? Was it watching this garbage on television? This second assassin, attempted assassin, down in Palm Beach, where was he radicalized? Was he watching Maxine Waters and Kamala Harris and Chuck Schumer and all the Democrats call President Trump Hitler and a threat to democracy? Was he being fed that propaganda? Is this part of a larger conspiracy? Are there online chat rooms that we don't know about where they talk about knocking off President Trump? All of this stuff has to be answered.
Preborn celebrates that Roe v. Wade has been overturned. Roe has been responsible for the slaughter of over 63 million babies. Now the decision to abort a child will be left in the hands of the states, and sadly, abortions will continue in the most liberal states. Over the past 16 years, Preborn has positioned their clinics in the top abortion cities where 50% of abortions occur. Preborn's work of saving babies' lives continues at an even greater level as they save babies' lives and defend their centers from the radical hate groups who want to shut them down. Preborn's response is dependent on you, the pro-life community. Be a part of rescuing lives and changing hearts for Christ. $28 sponsors one ultrasound, and $140 will help to rescue five babies' lives. Dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or go to preborn.com. All gifts are tax deductible.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to the program here on American Family Radio. I'm Walker Wildman. This is our last segment of the show. Just following up on some details that are still continuing to come out. Thus far, the suspect in the Trump assassination attempt has been charged with two firearm counts. So the feds are likely still compiling evidence enough to charge him for more counts than this, but right now, two firearm counts. He scratched out the serial number, reportedly, on the firearm. Let's see. He was very, very emotionally involved with the war in Ukraine. As I mentioned in the first segment, I actually traveled over there He tried to recruit people for the war in Ukraine, in favor of Ukraine. Once again, he reportedly hid in the sniper's nest at the golf course for nearly 12 hours before being spotted. The latest number is that he was 400 yards away from President Trump. President Biden is now admitting that President Trump needs more Secret Service, that the Secret Service needs more help to guard President Trump. You know, historically, I understand the rationalization of the Secret Service protecting, of course, the sitting president the most, and then other protectees outside of the sitting president and vice president receive Secret Service protection, but it's less involved, it's less detailed. I understand that because the sitting president and the sitting vice president, they're the consequence of them being assassinated or targeted, of course, is much higher than a former president. But in this case, this is different. Because not only is President Trump a major political party nominee for president, but he's also a highly targeted man. Whether we're talking Iran, whether we're talking North Korea, or any other foreign power that wants President Trump dead, he is a very targeted man. So the combination of all of these things should lead to President Trump having the same protection as President Biden at this point, especially after what happened in Butler, Pennsylvania. So we're in a different era of American politics. And as I played the last segment, the rhetoric is amped up, and it's amped up on the left. The rhetoric is amped up. They've been targeting President Trump for years and years now. And when you call someone a threat to democracy, when you overstate their significance and you compare them to Hitler and the Nazis, what do you expect to happen? What do you expect to happen? And the last clip that I want to play today is one of Representative Dan Goldman. He's a Democrat. And listen to the military type language that he uses when describing what needs to happen to President Trump. Clip one.
It is just unquestionable at this point that that man cannot see public office again. He is not only unfit, he is destructive to our democracy, and he has to be eliminated.
All right, well, there we have it. That's Representative Dan Goldman saying that President Trump needs to be quote-unquote eliminated. President Trump needs to be quote-unquote eliminated. I mean, this is the rhetoric, folks. This is the rhetoric that the Democrats and the media in conjunction have been using for, let's see, the last 8 years, 9 years, going back to 2015. And the stakes here, folks, and here's what we can't let happen. Here's what we can't let happen. We can't allow this intimidation to cause people to be so fearful that we lose sight and we lose the fight in this country. That's what they want. They want this rhetoric and these threats and these assassination attempts to cause you and I to go hide away in our safe place and not be engaged in the political system, not be engaged over the fight for our country. But we can't do that, folks. We cannot allow this fear factor to win. And what happens on November 5th with the election is just going to be an indication of whether this type of behavior, this type of rhetoric is going to be condoned, going to be encouraged, going to be incentivized, or whether we can finally put this terrible Biden and Harris administration behind us and move on to more civil discussions. But this is no doubt a spiritual battle in our country. And anyone who's in denial of that is not paying attention and doesn't have their eyes open. I do want to jump to our next guest. We do have with us Rebecca Dollahunt. She's Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Family Council. She's on with us now from the state of Minnesota. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Hello there. Thank you so much for having me today, Walker.
Well, Rebecca, you're obviously out of the state of Minnesota. You're public policy director at the Minnesota Family Council. So this is the state where Governor Tim Walz is from. It's where he's governor. And we've heard all this talk about Governor Walz and how moderate he is and how much of a homeboy he is. But we wanted to have somebody on from the state of Minnesota who's dealt with the governor's office on different legislative issues in the state and hear your vantage point as to who Governor Walz really is. So bring us up to speed.
Absolutely, Walker. Well, I'm joined also, I'm sure you're going to be asking my colleague Renee as well, who's here with me, about Governor Walz's policies that he has supported. But I wanted to focus today on his administration's support of so-called gender-affirming care and how that became one of his top priorities following abortion. So right after the Dobbs decision, the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, which is Minnesota's Democratic Party, took control of both bodies of our state legislature and the governor's office, of course. And like I said, ensuring access to so-called gender-affirming care became one of his top priorities. So for listeners who may not be familiar with that, that includes drugs to block puberty, large doses of cross-sex hormones, and body modification surgery. And that can include things from cosmetic facial surgery to changes to genitalia and mastectomies. Walker, there are so many concerns about these practices and the fact that children can't give informed consent to these procedures and drugs because they could permanently alter their sterility or other bodily functions should be reason enough for concern. But Governor Walz's administration is treating this as if it is a foregone conclusion. And so I was going to walk through a few of the policies that he has signed into law or his administration has supported, and also an executive order from him, if that sounds good with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And one more question, Rebecca. Did you say Renee is with you?
Right. Renee is here with me.
Oh, great.
Hey, Walker, good to be here.
Yep. Great. Yeah, Renee, once again, Renee Carlson is also on with Rebecca with us now. She's general counsel with True North Legal. Glad to have both of you in. I know that was our plan, but we had some tech issues. But yeah, go ahead, Rebecca, bring us up to speed on some of those legislative items that Governor Walz supported.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So Renee and I work on social issues, and like I said, I'm going to be addressing the issue of gender, and then Renee is going to address the issue of abortion. So right away, on March 8th, Governor Walz signed an executive order to ensure access to gender-affirming care in Minnesota. And this executive order stated that, quote, state agencies will coordinate to protect people or entities who are providing, assisting, seeking, or obtaining gender-affirming healthcare services. And also the report said that directed the Department of Health to prepare a report summarizing the scientific evidence about the safety and effectiveness of gender-affirming healthcare and its public health effects. And I just wanted to draw your attention to that because it's stating this as a foregone conclusion that the Department of Health is going to say, of course, this is safe and effective. So right on the heels of that, Walker, the legislature was moving the kidnapping bill, House Bill 146, through the legislature. Hmm. And nationally, and likely in next week's vice presidential debate, you'll hear this referred to as the so-called trans refuge bill. There are many concerning things that we could share with your listeners, but I did want to focus on one aspect of it, which added a third category for a child to be taken from his or her parents. So until 2023, a court of Minnesota could take temporary emergency jurisdiction of a child when there is evidence that the child has been abused or neglected. But this bill added a third category to Minnesota statute that the child has been unable to receive gender-affirming care. So our state government considers children's inability to get quote-unquote gender-affirming care such an abuse of the child's rights that the court, a court of the state, can take temporary emergency jurisdiction of the child. And I just wanted to clarify, this is a matter of family law in which a court can take temporary jurisdiction to determine if the child can go back to the parents or if the child needs to go into the system. But I just wanted to reiterate that it is our state government's position that access to gender-affirming care is one of its highest priorities. In that same legislative session, state statute was changed so that medical assistance, which is state taxpayer-funded insurance, covers so-called gender-affirming healthcare services Nearly all health insurance plans offered in Minnesota now must cover gender-affirming care. There are some exemptions for religious organizations and nonprofits. And then I also wanted to address the Equal Rights Amendment, which is a proposed constitutional amendment that did not pass both bodies of our legislature in time by the end of our biennium here. But the ERA would provide constitutional protection for every individual, so that's adult and child, to define their own gender and related gender-affirming care. And so I just wanted to reiterate, this is not moderate. This does not reflect a moderate position, and I think folks are not aware of that generally. And so I just wanted to make sure that people were aware as we head into this election season of Governor Walz and his administration's position on gender-affirming care and parental rights to that effect.
Yeah, Rebecca, that legislation that enables the state to kidnap children if parents don't want to give their children cross-sex hormones or mutilate their bodies through surgery, that's reason enough. I mean, that is red flag galore,
right?
The fact that that was Governor Walz's position in the state of Minnesota. Renee, tell us about the abortion issue. I mean, this is just one thing after another that is proving that Governor Walz is a far left radical. Tell us about the abortion issue.
Well, we've certainly had a radical overhaul of our previous laws with respect to abortion and guardrails that protect women, children, and of course, these vulnerable preborn babies in the state of Minnesota. So in 2023, out the gate, Governor Walz and his administration, as well as the majority of legislators, said that their first priority was to ensure a fundamental right to abortion. And so in 2023, the legislature passed a bill that was signed into law in which a fundamental right to abortion with unfettered access to abortion on demand on the taxpayer's dime ended up becoming one of our new laws. That is abortion up to birth for any individual. So this walker also includes minors. And it's not just a fundamental right to abortion, but as I said, it's a fundamental right to abortion without any guardrails. That's because they passed another bill in their large health omnibus bill, which repealed nearly all of our health and safety protections with any woman or our daughters, young girls, as young as 12 years old who are seeking an abortion. So what does that mean? The repeal of the informed consent law, which simply required women and sadly girls to be informed about what happens to their body when they get an abortion. The repeal of the 24-hour waiting period between receiving this information and actually getting an abortion. Repeal of the physician-only law, which required physicians only to provide an abortion because, as we know, abortions often cause very dangerous medical complications. Now, it is not restricted to just physicians. In fact, my question is, who cannot provide an abortion? Also, the repeal of the hospital-only law, which required abortions after the first trimester to be performed in an abortion. And something to that point is, if you take notice of the Attorney General's website, you'll see that he's also promoting telehealth with respect to abortions. We know that there's a lot of talk about mailing mifepristone and misopropyl across the mail to young girls who are seeking an abortion. So Walker, we're concerned that these young girls might be taking these dangerous abortion drugs, having abortions, and potentially bleeding out on their bathroom floors. So not only that, if that wasn't extreme enough and progressive enough, we also had an amendment, which essentially functioned as a repeal, to the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. So the Born Alive Infants Protection Act was passed in 2015 and required medical professionals to provide life-saving care for infants born alive who survive an abortion. Well, that language was amended. So instead of preserving the life of the infant who is born alive, now the statute simply requires comfort care. And Rebecca and I were in that hearing. We were there. We testified and also listened to a state legislator who is an EMT say that comfort care is definitely different than preserving life-saving care. It's different from respiratory care. So we have strong concerns about what happens now to infants born alive who survive an abortion? And the previous reporting requirements, if you may have heard, it's all over Twitter, it's all over social media. This is verifiably true. Those reporting requirements were removed from the statute. No longer are those reports required. But what we do have is Governor Walz and his administration's own Minnesota Department of Health verifiably saying that five infants in 2021 did survive an abortion, were born alive. We know that to be true of three infants also in 2019. I mean, you know, I could go on about some other repealers and other things, but those are the general things that are coming out of Minnesota that just show, again, this is not a moderate administration, especially when it comes to women's health.
Thanks so much, Renee. Once again, Renee Carlson and Rebecca Delahot out of Minnesota. Tim Walz is not a moderate.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.